Good morning, everyone. I'm keenly aware that we are the last speakers before lunch. So, and in looking back over my presentation, I maybe made a mistake because some of my bullet points are little fruits and other food products. So I apologize for those of you who are hungry. But on that note, I will try to get through the presentation effectively and efficiently so that we can enjoy breaking bread together and hearing from my colleague, with the Robert Johnson Foundation over lunch, Michelle Larkin. So I'm really excited to have the opportunity today to talk to you about the Public Health Law Network. It seems new, although when I reflect back, we started operations September 15th of 2010 and spent approximately, I don't know, somewhere between 5 and 6 months even preparing for the launch of the network. So maybe we're not as nascent as it seems to me still standing here today. But I imagine many of you in the room still have yet to hear about what the network is, how you might be a part of the network, and how you might use the network's resources. So I'm happy to have the opportunity to talk to you about that today. Obviously, most importantly, when you're talking about any new initiative is to acknowledge the grant, the grantor. In this instance is the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. I think many of you could raise your hands in the audience and say that on some level your salary is supported by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and that's a good thing. So I want to acknowledge the foundation. But what really makes sense is that the mission of the foundation, at its core, is to help the society transform itself for the better, using health as the focus. On improving society, and that's the instigation behind the creation of projects like the Public Health Law Network, funding of the Hilltop Institute, and the like. The composition of the network starts with the National Coordinating Center, which is technically based at the William Mitchell College of Law in Minnesota, but is directed by Dan Steer. Many of you may have known Dan when he was with CDC, previously with the Wisconsin Department of Health and Attorney General's Office. Dan lives still in Wisconsin, though makes regular trips to Minnesota. So we really are a virtual network in many regards. Dan's the executive director of the National Coordinating Center, and he has staff who work with him as the National Coordinating Center. Dan is not, doesn't consider himself our boss in any way, and again, that's another part of our network is that we are all spokes coming out from a hub. But those spokes consist of 5 regional offices. Here in Maryland, at the University of Maryland School of Law, we house the Eastern region, and as you can see, there are 4 other regions around the state, more details about which will come on other slides. I want to acknowledge, however, our significant partners in this venture. The Public Health Law Research Program out of Temple University School of Law is one of our integral partners that funds these mini grants, funding research that helps us understand whether laws and regulations and policies that have been put into effect to change health outcomes are actually working. If they're not working, why they're not working. If they are working, why they are working. And so the Public Health Law Research Program is an integral part to the Public Health Law Network. The NPLAN, the National Policy and Legal Analysis Network to Prevent Childhood Obesity, which is part of the Public Health Institute in California, really addresses questions that arise related to obesity prevention for the network. So because RWJ was already funding that initiative, we have included them in our network. Same thing with the Tobacco Control Legal Consortium, which is also out of William Mitchell College of Law in Minnesota. So to the extent that tobacco-related questions are presented to the network or tobacco-related work is being done, it's principally being done through TCLC. The caveat being many of you sitting in the room know me in my capacity as the director of the Center for Tobacco Regulation, which is a Maryland-based institution or a Maryland-based center working on public health policy and tobacco control and prevention. And so when your questions come related to tobacco to the Eastern region, we don't ship them off to TCLC because we have the in-house expertise to handle them. So though it's always nice to have the sounding board of our national experts at TCLC. And I added here our newest partner, the Hilltop Institute, because Over the course of the last several months, we have been starting to talk about how we can and should be working together on a lot of our joint initiatives that make sense. So certainly the Hilltop Institute is a significant partner. And then obviously the rest of you in this room. This is a network. This is designed to be a network. And it only works if people join, number one. So you can see on the bottom of the screen, which is in your packet, here's how you join. There's the link to join the network. It's not just a numbers game, but there is a little competition between the regions. And so if you're from the Eastern region, I'll give you a nickel if you join join the network. But in any case, it really is about bringing together individuals from many different disciplines into this network so that we're not constantly recreating the wheel in Wisconsin that was already created in West Virginia or Florida, so that we're learning from each other's experiences and enhancing each other's work instead of repeating it. But who really comprises the network at this point? National, state, tribal, and local public health officials. So I see Dr. Barbeau from Baltimore City, the health commissioner for Baltimore City. She's one of our best members of our network. She knows how to call us and reach out for assistance, and she and her staff certainly do so. That's a perfect example of a member of the network who at the same time requesting resources. There are times when accomplishments that Baltimore City has achieved will serve as examples for other jurisdictions, and we may say, you know what, why don't you call so-and-so at Baltimore City Health Department? They went through this process just last year. They're going to help you talk you through that process. But also, the attorneys for the local health departments and the state health departments are also important components in the network process. I can't provide legal advice. We'll talk about that in a second. They can, but we can help them get to honing down to what the real legal advice necessary in the process is. Advocacy and educational organizations are also members, so most of the major public health organizations we encourage to become part of the network. And then the area where we're really endeavoring to deepen our membership is in the research community. So those of you who are, Dr. DeClemente and I have a great relationship in tobacco world, where they conduct the sound science to evaluate policy. It doesn't make sense if they sit in their ivory tower here at UMBC, and we're in our ivory tower down at the University of Maryland Law School working on policy if we're not talking to each other. So that's why we really want the researchers to become part of the network. You can access the resources of the network without becoming a member, but it's to your benefit to join as a member. You'll get a couple of alerts and newsletter once every other week, not an overwhelming amount of email. Put your Gmail account down if you want, that's fine, but no private information. But we really are encouraging, and that's where we would like to really deepen our relationship. So obviously all of you in the room. What really is the Public Health Law Network? And I'm not necessarily the best PowerPoint person, though I understand Michelle Larkin has one heck of a PowerPoint coming at lunch, but I have a web here at least, as usual. Really connecting all of us, like I said, so the public health policymakers like Dr. Barbeau, Dr. Bielenson, Dr. Morhaime, Delegate Eckhart in the room, who are trying to find ways to use their legislative or regulatory power to improve health, but are coming up against legal hurdles, can reach out to attorneys within the network to say, is the First Amendment an impediment here? Is there a Commerce Clause problem here? But can also reach out to the researchers in the network to say, the lawyers have said they've done this in these particular jurisdictions. Is it working there? Why is it working? Why is it not working? So that we can all seamlessly work to develop policy, surveil policy, evaluate policy, and then, when necessary, deconstruct or enhance policy. Where each of the regions are housed, not particularly important here, but the National Coordinating Center also contains the northern region. You can see the states that comprise the northern region. They have a couple of areas of special focus. The first would be cross-border issues. Obviously, they're at the northern part of the country, and so we have a lot of issues where there may be the need to share information, data, and the like with our colleagues or with our friends in Canada, or there are cross-border issues, obviously, to the south of us as well. And they also, because TCLC is in the northern region, they also are the point team for tobacco. The western region, and I just returned from a trip in Colorado, and I decided that this is where I could probably live of all these other regions. It was just beautiful there. But you can see they also got Hawaii in their region. There was a little bit of fighting over who got Hawaii, but they got it in the western region. Their focus points, of course, tribal law being a very significant issue in the western region, although we do have some tribes here in the eastern region, but out west there are more tribes. And there are significant issues that, you know, we may think, oh, this is how you address a problem, you know, with a local health department or through the state health department or state legislature. But when we're talking about tribal law, a lot of what we know and think about law is very different, and what we think about power and culture is very different. And so it's nice that we have colleagues who are very knowledgeable about the differences in tribal law. Also, they are the emergency preparedness experts for the network. The Mid-States region, which does include, you might think Pennsylvania is in the eastern region, but it's over here in the Mid-States region. Health information data sharing, so a lot of issues that are arising out of the electronic medical records and the like, a lot of those issues are addressed here by our Mid-States region, as well as kind of the foundational questions about who has the power to do what in public health, state, local, federal, et cetera, are some of the key points addressed in our Mid-States region. Our Southeastern region, and Corey, are you in the room? Corey Davis back there, I have not met in person, so I didn't know that he was in the room, is from our Southeastern region, who took Virginia from us. So also Virginia, that you might have thought was in our region, is actually in the Southeastern region. And they are your go-to people on the Affordable Care Act, on your healthcare reform stuff. A significant relationship with NHELP helps them in satisfying that obligation. But also issues related to, I know for a lot of the public health practitioners in the room, this word is scary, but accreditation of state and local public health departments and regionalization, another scary word, I think, or shared service delivery within the public health community. And so, you know, that's your go-to, and I'm pointing out Corey, so if you have any Affordable Care Act questions, you can just line up during the lunch to talk with Corey. And then, of course, here in the eastern region, you can see what our states are. Our focal points, as Alicia indicated, are injury prevention, environmental health, and food safety. I just want to point out some significant partnerships that we have, one with the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, the Center for Injury Policy that we work with there, who Delegate Moorhane knows quite well, as well as the Environmental Law Program and the Health Law Program at the University of Maryland School of Law. So, why did the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation create the Public Health Law Network? Again, I talked to you about the specifics of linking people together, but the purpose that we, when we all sat down before the launch and came up with the words that we wanted to define the purpose, here they are. You know, to increase the use and effectiveness of public health laws in protecting, promoting, and improving public health so that policymakers understand and can use their power effectively and as broadly as they can. Very often we know public health officials think that there's a legal hurdle to doing something, and so they don't pursue an option further, whereas talking to an attorney who really understands public health law might either find a different avenue for them to approach the problem that they're thinking about, or may resolve that there isn't a particular legal hurdle involved. How do we do our work? Three primary functions. The first is technical assistance. The second, proactive deliverables, and the third, just the mere creation of the network so that we have the sharing going on. Technical assistance typically is provided, at least thus far, to state and local public health officials. You know, usually there's staff from a local health department or a state health department will call and say, for example, we want to encourage school gardens, but we know there are a tremendous number of school-based as well as environmental-based regulations about the growing and eating of food in the school system. Can you help us maneuver through that legal minefield and set up a program within our local school system so that they can have school gardens and the children can actually consume the food that they grow in their garden? You probably wouldn't be shocked to find that there is a minefield to get to that point where a child's able to grow his own green bean and then eat it. If you can get him to do that. Having a son who doesn't eat vegetables, I have fruit, so I might fly here. In any case, so that's the technical assistance is really when someone is facing a particular, we want to do this from a policy perspective, we don't know what the legal, legal issues might be here, or we know, hey, we're concerned. Do we have a problem with the First Amendment if we tell doctors they're not allowed to ask you if you have a gun in the home? Actually, that might be a First Amendment problem, but they rewrote the law, I think, to avoid that problem. But that's the technical assistance. We also spend a significant amount of time out in the community. For example, Carrie Lowry, who works with me, is going to be at the NACHO conference later this month or in July. And you're just doing that networking. What are the issues that people are talking about? We've had needs assessment meetings with state and local health officials within our region to say, where do you feel that you have the need for legal services? Where do you feel you would work more if you had answers to your legal questions or to your questions about what sound policy might exist in this field? So it takes, many forms. My favorite new word is webinar, so we put on a webinar every other month. Fact sheets, issue briefs, and the like, and you can look at our website and see what has already been produced. I can tell you for the Eastern region, we've done a lot of work recently on hydrofracturing, which is a way to release natural gas from shale deep beneath the Earth's surface. It presents very significant public health and environmental health concerns. And so we have had a webinar. We're about to release fact sheets and some other documents related to hydrofracturing, as well as a significant amount of resource in an upcoming webinar on concussion in youth sports and how policymakers, could approach changes in the law to minimize the risk of harm to children from concussion in youth sports. So those are just some of the examples of the products we create. But the creation of the network is the most important part. Tying together the people who need to talk to each other, providing a mechanism for them to find each other, and then serving as the liaison to connect them. So I talked about technical assistance and gave you a couple of examples, but it's important to us that we distinguish what we can do and what we cannot do for you. So if anyone in this room were to call and say, Kathy, can I fire this person or would that be a violation of EEO laws? Don't ask me that. Number one, I'm not an employment lawyer. Number two, I'm always tempted to answer a question I don't know the answer to because that's what we do. So don't put me in that position. As my husband says, you'll just make it up if you don't know. But most importantly is I'm not barred to practice law except in the jurisdiction of Maryland. So I don't want to lose that license to practice in Maryland. I don't want to get sued for practicing in Maryland, and I don't want to get sued for practicing outside of Maryland. And more importantly, Robert Wood Johnson doesn't want to get sued for any of my activities. So you can read the definitions, and I actually drew these directly from what, again, we all agreed on in creating the network, were the differences between legal advice and technical legal assistance. So as not to run myself afoul of what these rules are. But typically legal advice is when you have a very specific set of facts, a very specific law in question, applying it to a specific person or entity and saying, is there a legal problem with doing that? Can we do that lawfully? That is technical advice to say, no, Dr. Barbeau, you cannot go in and seize, all of the assets of this restaurant because they're in violation of the local health code. Or yes, that may, that's her lawyer can answer that question. The county attorney or the city attorney can answer that question, but we won't be able to do that at the network. Technical legal assistance is saying we're having a continuing problem with restaurants that are in violation of the county health code. What can we do to improve compliance? What other enforcement mechanisms might we have? What other punishment mechanisms might be put in place to encourage compliance? And they could come to us and we could, talk about what the legal avenues might be available, what sound research, what evidence-based research shows us works to improve the compliance with local health regulations in restaurants. My time is flying by, so I'm going to start talking even faster. We can't lobby, period. So we won't, you can't call us and say, will you come in and testify before Delegate Eckhart, I don't know what committee you're on, I'm sorry, but to come in and say, pass this law or don't pass this law. On the other hand, if Delegate Morhaime or Delegate Eckhart called and said, I'm interested in effectuating policy to improve children's access to healthy foods in certain communities, here's the legislative proposal I'm looking at, can you give me some feedback on that? Would you come and testify about what other states have done, any of the case law related to what those states have done if they've been challenged or the like, and talk in an expert capacity to the legislative committee? Absolutely, we can do that. We won't cross that line and say, and so you should pass this law or you should not pass this law, but we can certainly provide that level of expertise. So it says my time is up. I'm just going to very quickly talk about what we can do with respect to community health needs or what we're planning to do. What role might the network do with the Affordable Care Act's community health needs requirements. So a budding relationship with the Hilltop Institute. So we're working collaboratively with Hilltop. So to the extent that if you have legal questions or questions about community health needs, whether you should call Hilltop or us, don't worry. If you call them and it should be us, they'll call us or vice versa. So you should think of us as a seamless unit. But we are intending to create some product that we hope will help policymakers or advocates who are seeking to change through policy to what would be best for this jurisdiction to address the community health needs requirements. So we know from the issue briefs that Hilltop has already put out some of the questions that are extant. How do we define community to figure out what the community health needs are? Is that a demographic or is that a geographic? And if it's geographic, or are there segments of the population that have serious health needs, but it's only 10% of the population? So if we look at our raw numbers, we don't have a hypertension problem in this jurisdiction. But in 10% of the community, we have a very profound hypertension problem. Is that, how do we include that in the definition of community so that real community health needs can be addressed or are addressed in this process? Who should be involved from the community? What entities are entitled to state-level nonprofit status? Most states just adopt the federal. If you're a nonprofit entity for federal purposes, you are for state law purposes. That does not have to be the case. State and local jurisdictions or states can add requirements on top of that. Why should you? Why would you? What would you do in that circumstance? What agency should be enforcing this law? Should this be local, state, an executive regulation, policy guidance, or an actual statute? So these are some of the questions that we're hoping together the Hilltop Institute and the network will address and put out some proactive products that will help policymakers and advocates as we're starting to really look at the community health needs, the requirements to meet those community health needs for our nonprofit institutions, that we have policy guidance law in effect that I think effectuates what the ACA was designed to do. So with that, I think I'm just going to flip through the last couple of slides and let you come up. Thank you.